So ever since I was a little kid, I always assumed that there were giants in mountains. It's just what I grew up with. I don't know if it was from, you know, as a little guy watching the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, you know, little animation, you know, how they're like half wooden, half animated, doing all that jazz, right? And the Abominable Snowman, you remember him? Yukon T. Cornelius is always going to have the Bumble, right? He lived in the mountains, kind of the, you know, the cold, icy mountains or whatever. So maybe that planted a seed, I don't know. Or maybe it was reading The Lord of the Rings growing up and reading about the stone giants that are in, you know, Middle Earth in the mountains there and the stone giants. Maybe it was that. I have no idea, but I've always assumed that giants lived in mountains. I mean, it's not like you go looking for Bigfoot on the plains of Kansas, right? No one has any shots of Bigfoot on the plains of Kansas. Right, it's always in some mountainous region or whatever, right? Yetis live in the mountains, all right? And if you're going to be hiking anywhere, like in the Himalayas, just know, there's Yetis. Do not bring beef jerky. Bad idea, all right? It's just a little joke. About four of you got it, which was fantastic. So we started off really, really well. There's also these kind of, local legends in places like the Solomon Islands, Guadalcanal area, where, you know, the locals there say that there are literal giants living there. This is a place, I don't know, I think it's northeast of Australia in the kind of Solomon Islands there. And they say, you know, they've got this massive circuit of caves and stuff, but they live in the mountains, literal giants, you know. So I have no idea. I've never been there, never sought them out, anything, but I've just always assumed that giants lived in mountains. Well, when Trace, before he was headed to college a few weeks back when we were on vacation, I decided that we were going to do something because I thought, you know what, he's about to take on some giants in his world and going to a university, and so let's go ahead, and you know, it's going to be a kind of a big mountain that he's going to have to tackle, so let's go tackle a mountain before he has to tackle a mountain. So I thought to myself, you know what, let's go climb a mountain, dude. Literally, that's what I said. And so we ended up building a few days around. We brought our whole family, but Trace and I were going to specifically climb a mountain, and I just decided we're going to go climb the highest peak in the state of New York, Mount Marcy in the Adirondacks. It's the highest place. Some of you guys have climbed that before, and some of you that aren't here, you tried and you died, much like I almost did. So we headed there and we spent some time there. My whole focus was on climbing Mount Marcy. You know, it was we're not climbers. Like, we didn't prepare. We didn't even have stuff, right? I had like a school backpack with some sandwiches and waters, and I had a flashlight, and I had a pocket knife that I think we gave to men like years and years ago. It said the chapel at Cross Point on it. And there's not even a knife in it. There's like a small spoon about the size of, you know, I don't know who could use it, but I don't. So anyway, that's what I had basically on me, and a little bit of mosquito repellent. So I was very prepared, me and Trace both, because we just came into it stupidly. Like, we're just, yeah, what's the deal? We've been over to, you know, Glen Falls before. We can hike up this bad boy. I mean, what do you got? You just got to walk, right? Well, then I started telling him, he's like, well, so how high is it? And I was like, it's pretty high. And how long does it take? I don't really know, but a while. It's going to take a while. Well, do you know how long it is? And then I looked it up and I went, yeah, it's 15 miles. He was like, he said, what? And I said, yeah, it's 15 miles. 15 miles. Yeah. I've never traveled 15 miles on my feet before in any one setting. I've traveled 15 miles in a car. I've traveled 15 miles on a bike. I've never traveled 15 miles on my feet, let alone climbing a mountain that's the tallest peak in the state of New York. So we started going, okay, yeah, this could be a problem. So we decided, where most people that we found out that were in that Lake Placid area, most people were taking this mountain on in 2 days because they camp. So they go up a ways, you know, and then they camp, and then they go, you know, the rest of the way and stuff. Not us. We're doing it all in a day. So we're just saying, hey, let's just do it, man. You know, so we got up early, and we went, and you have to sign in right before you leave in case you don't come back. And they can go, yeah, he didn't come back. We need to go find them people.
And so we take off and we're walking, starting down the trail. Edie and Tanner said goodbye to us, and then they went and hiked somewhere else, and we're heading off, you know, to go tackle Mount Marcy. So we start walking down the trail, and for the first little while, the funny thing is you have to walk 2 miles before you even really get started. And I was like, oh, that's cool, because, I mean, we were walking, and I was just like, this ain't nothing. It's nothing, man. What's up with this? This is nothing. I got this. And then you get to the Mount Marcy Dam, and after that, it gets real. It gets real up in here right after the Marcy Dam. So anyway, we're walking. The first thing that kind of started to wig me out, because I was thinking, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking giants. You know, there's probably giants here because they live in the mountains. And as we're walking, I see a sign, and it's the first. It wasn't very long into the end of the walk, and Trace goes, oh, that's an encouraging sign. And it basically said this, stay on the trail. There's black bears all over the place, and it like implied, and they want to eat you. Now I'm thinking to myself, why would it matter if I stay on the trail or if I don't? Is there some kind of like invisible barrier where the bear comes up and goes, whoa, that's the trail. I'm not getting on the trail. No chance. Whew, you better be lucky. He's just walking with him. You better be lucky you're on the trail, man. I know. So I'm thinking, what does that matter, right? Looking at Trace like, oh, we're on the trail. Well, no bear's going to eat us on the trail. Ridiculous. So we walk and we sweat and I'm, you know, we're dying going up this thing. He's probably not really. He's in pretty good shape and I'm 45 and we're walking and doing the best we can, right? And none of it's even surface. You're walking rocks the whole way up. Like big rocks, big boulders, you know, you can only take so much of that. And then you're really starting to climb. And there was a point where not only had we gotten away from the bear giants, which was good, we didn't see any and no one ate us, but there's also kind of emotional giants that hit you in the mountains as well. And so we were headed up and all of a sudden, you know, the trees are starting to get a little bit thinner. And I'm thinking, oh man, I didn't check. I didn't have a watch on or anything and hadn't pulled my phone out. I felt like we had been walking at this point, I don't know, for 100 years, something like that. I mean, I knew by the time I got to the bottom of this, I would be cashing Social Security checks. It was taking forever. And I'm thinking, we've got to be close. But all the whole walk, we were undercover. So we're under tree cover, so we can't see anything. And climbers would tell you it's really difficult when you can't ever see the summit. You don't know how far you're going, what you're doing. So we just kept going. And then all of a sudden, the tree started to thin out a little bit. And we looked up, and there was a clearing up in front of us. And we were like, yes, man, we're getting close. So we walk out, and we get to this clearing. And there's two dudes, they're probably in their early 20s, that are sitting on a big rock in this clearing. And I'm just over there talking to them, just like this. I was like, what's up, guys? And they're like, hey, what's going on? They said, what time did you leave? We said, we left at 8. And they're like, what? We left at 7. You've made up an hour on us? You guys are humming. What's the deal with that? And I said, we don't want to get eaten. We don't want to die. And we want to get back before it gets dark because we're doing this in a day. And all I've got is this thing, you know, it's got a little spoon on it. So like if a black bear comes, I'm going to spoon him up. Back on, we'll spoon you down, boy. Right? So I'm talking to these guys. They probably think we're idiots. And Trace is probably looking at me like, Dad, you should just stop talking and like eat a sandwich and let's keep moving. So I looked at the guys and I said, have you guys been to the summit already? And they're like, no, we're headed there. And I was like, okay, cool. I said, have you done this before? And they said, no. And I said, well, we got to be getting close. And the guy pointed over my shoulder. I turned and looked, and there's the summit in the clouds. And it looked like it was a completely other mountain than the one I was standing on. And I went, no, man. I said, we're climbing Mount Marcy. And he went, and I just looked at it, and inside of me, I was thinking to myself, I'm out. We are done here. I didn't say that out loud, but inside, I was sucking my thumb. I wanted a warm glass of milk. I was sucking my thumb, and I was crying for my mommy right then. Because, I mean, I'm already out of gas. My legs are burning. And I'm thinking to myself, there's just no way that's going to happen. What I realized in that moment is that there are no half-hearted mountains. So there can't be half-hearted climbers. You just got to get with it and get it done, or else you're going to be stranded up there in the dark with your small spoon fighting off the bears that don't come on apparently to the path. Eventually, we got to the summit. It took, another month and a half or whatever, and we got to the summit, and we had to scramble the last quarter mile. And for those of you who climb, you know what scrambling is. It's kind of half climbing, half hiking, and you've just got bare rock face for about a quarter of a mile that you're just having to, I was having to use hands and feet, kind of, you know, working my way up this, and it felt like it was this. It wasn't, but it felt like it was this. And, you know, your legs are already tired. We got to the summit. It was awesome. We had a blast. It was great. And then we ended up getting down, and it was horrifyingly bad. Coming down was like 1,000 times worse than going up. Because when your quads are already shot, it means you have no ankle support. And you're going down on rocks the whole time. And I looked like the scarecrow from the Wizard of Oz. Everything, I'm just going down like this. Trace, let's go. Let's get down there. Mom's coming. We got to get down there before we get. That's what I look like. Like, I was like, it was like I was a walking milkshake. Man. But we made it. And that was good. We took the mountain. We took the mountain. Yeah. So, that was just a few weeks ago, and I'm still in counseling. Here's the thing. The people of God are mountain takers. That's what the people of God are. They're mountain takers. You see, I need you to understand that even though the people of God are mountain takers, there are giants in the mountains. I want to call you to kind of a beautiful story in the story of redemption. And in just a moment, I want you to look in the book of Joshua, chapter number 14. We'll be there in just a minute. But this story, in the story of redemption, let me give you some background. Israel has just been in captivity in Egypt for a very long time, hundreds of years. God raises up Moses to lead them out. And upon leading them out, they are headed for the land of promise. They are leaving the bondage of Egypt, and they are headed for the land of promise. God said, I'm going to give you a place. I'm going to give you a place that's going to be your own. It's a place that I have decided for you to be. It's a place that I have promised you even before this time, but I'm going to lead my people into that. And so the people of God start making their way toward the land of promise. And at some point in this journey, Moses appoints and says, I want 12 spies, one from each of the tribes of Israel, and I'm going to send them into the land, and I want you to spend 40 days on a recon mission. I want you to gather up all the information you can. What kind of place is this? Who lives there? Who's already there? Is it fruitful? What does this place look like? Tell me about this place. And so, sure enough, he appoints 12 spies, and those 12 spies make their way into the land of promise. And they're there for 40 days, and upon coming back, they come back and bring a report that the land certainly is flowing with milk and honey. They even brought back a vine cluster of grapes that was so large that it took two men to be able to hoist it up and carry it. This is the kind of land that they were going into. And it was absolutely startling. But 10 of the 12 of those spies said, but here's the problem. As awesome a land as it is, and I can see why God has given this to us and designated this for us, there's no way we're ever going to be able to inhabit it because the people that live there are giants. We look like grasshoppers in their sight. They are giants, and we're never going to be able to do this. But there were two of those spies, Joshua and Caleb. Those two spies, Caleb stopped them, everybody, because everybody was getting scared. And he said, hang on a second. We can do this. God has given this to us. We can do this. But the 10, they were the overwhelming majority voice, and all of the hearts of the people of Israel started melting in fear. They were scared to death, and they realized, we can't do this. We're not going to do this. It doesn't matter that God said this. We're still not going to do it because these people are giants, and there's no way that we're going to be able to do this. Eventually, God said, well, Moses, they're not listening to me, and they're not believing me, and so here's what's going to happen. Every single one of those spies, none of them is going to make it into the land of promise. They're all going to die in the wilderness, except for Joshua and Caleb. And by the way, the whole generation of people that of the people of Israel that chooses not to believe me, they're also going to die in the wilderness, because now you're going to walk around in the wilderness 1 year for every day that the spies were in the land. 40. 1 year for every day. And so they did. And a whole generation passed away, and the younger generation was going to have the opportunity to come into the land of promise. And God, upon Moses' departure, raises up Joshua to be leader of the people, and he leads the people into the land of promise, and the people that are already there in the land of Canaan, the Canaanites of various different ites, right? Hittites and Jebusites and mosquito bites and electric lights and all of those, right? There's a bazillion of them. And so they're all there, and they have to now begin, over the process of time, systematically beginning to drive them out of the land. And as they do, in that systematic time frame, there comes a time where Joshua, because of what God had promised, Joshua begins to allot the land to the tribes of Israel. This will be yours. This will be yours. And so I want you to pick up in Joshua chapter number 14, beginning in verse 6, it says this. Now the people of Judah approached Joshua at Gilgal, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, said to him, you know what the Lord said to Moses, the man of God, at Kadesh Barnea about you and me. I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to explore the land. And I brought him back a report according to my convictions, but my fellow Israelites who went up with me made the hearts of the people melt in fear. I, however, followed the Lord my God wholeheartedly. So on that day, Moses swore to me, the land on which your feet have walked will be your inheritance and that of your children forever, because you have followed the Lord my God wholeheartedly. Now then, just as the Lord promised, he has kept me alive for 45 years since the time he said this to Moses, while Israel moved about in the wilderness. So here I am today, 85 years old. I am still as strong today as the day Moses sent me out. I'm just as vigorous to go out to battle now as I was then. Now give me this mountain, or give me this hill country that the Lord promised me that day. You yourself heard then that the Anakites were there and their cities were large and fortified, but the Lord helping me, I will drive them out just as he said. Then Joshua blessed Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and gave him Hebron as his inheritance. So Hebron has belonged to Caleb, son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, ever since, because he followed the Lord, the God of Israel, wholeheartedly. Now, in this passage, we definitely begin to learn some things about Caleb. We learn that Caleb is 85 years old, right? But he's full of vigor. He says, hey, it's been 45 years since this promise was made to us, and I'm ready to claim it. I'm ready to go. I'm ready to go into battle right now. I'm just as ready as I was 45 years ago. Wouldn't we all love that, right? At 85, to be able to go, I feel 40. Some of us are 40, and we go, I feel 85, right? We would love to be able to. So we know this about Caleb. He was 85. He was full of vigor. We also know that he was full of faith. He trusted God's promise. We also know that he was patient. He waited a long time to see this come to be, right? He had to be extraordinarily patient. But we also know, back in the book of Numbers, we also find out that Caleb had a different spirit than everybody else had. Listen to how it's described in Numbers chapter 14. God says, not one of them will ever see the land I promised on oath to their ancestors. No one who has treated me with contempt will ever see it. But because my servant Caleb has a different spirit and follows me wholeheartedly, I will bring him into the land he went to, and his descendants will inherit it. He had a different spirit than all of the other spies and all of those who were not believing God. Caleb had a different spirit. It was a spirit that said, I'm trusting God. I have faith in God. It was another way to say that is he had a unique spirit. It was different than everyone else's who was in disbelief, and he was choosing to obey God. And we also know, according to this passage, that he was a wholehearted follower of God, which is a beautiful picture. Now, here's the thing with Caleb. Caleb finally gets into and waits all of this time, and Joshua allots the land to him in Hebron and says, hey, this is yours, Caleb. But here's the thing. For Caleb to take that mountain, it was not going to be easy. In fact, look back with me in Joshua chapter 14 in verse number 12. It says, he says, now give me this mountain or give me this hill country that the Lord promised me that day. You yourself heard then that the Anakites were there and their cities were large and fortified, but the Lord helping me, I will drive them out just as he said. Here's the thing. You may not pay much attention to what's said there, but the Anakites inhabited it. In other words, the Anakites are the descendants of Anak. And Anak is related to, from a descendant standpoint, the Nephilim. Let me break it down for you. They were giants. Literal giants. So, in essence, you could say this. There were giants standing on the promise given to Caleb. Caleb was promised Hebron, but there were giants standing on his promise. That's important for us, and we'll come back to that in just a second, but you need to understand that Hebron, this place, had a history. You may or may not know some of the history related to Hebron, but the history goes back a long way before even this time. In fact, you could almost work back close to around, I'm just using round numbers, go half a millennium backwards. Go 500 years backwards, and here's what you'll find. You'll find a man who was living, he was from Ur of the Chaldees, named Abraham. Abraham was given a promise by God back in the book of Genesis when we read about that, and the promise was this, that you're going to be a great nation. Remember, he didn't have any kids at the time and was getting pretty old. You're going to be a great nation, and I'm going to bless you, and I'm going to make you a blessing. And he says that your descendants are going to inhabit a land that I am going to promise you. And then he sends Abraham basically into that land. And do you know where Abraham actually made his dwelling for quite some time? Hebron. Genesis tells us this in Genesis 13. So Abram went to live near the great trees of Mamre at Hebron, where he pitched his tents. There he built an altar to the Lord. You know, he was there long enough. Now, granted, his wife was quite old as he was, but he was there long enough to where when his wife Sarah died, he buried her there at Hebron. In fact, listen to what it says in Genesis 23. Sarah lived to be 127 years old. She died at Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan, and Abraham went to mourn for Sarah and to weep over her. Afterward, Abraham buried his wife Sarah in the cave in the field of Machpelah near Mamre, which is at Hebron in the land of Canaan. So the field and the cave in it were deeded to Abraham by the Hittites as a burial site. So now Abraham, he actually owns land in the land of promise. And this is the place where he ended up burying his wife Sarah. Now, when Abraham died, do you know what happened? They buried Abraham with Sarah in Hebron. Abraham had a son. You remember his son, Isaac, right? The child of promise. Isaac ultimately ended up dying, and so did his wife, Rebekah. And do you know where they were buried? They were buried with Abraham and Sarah in Hebron. And you know, Isaac had a son, the son that was named Jacob, and Jacob had a wife named Leah. He also had a wife named Rachel. Rachel died giving birth on the way right outside of Bethlehem and was buried there. But Jacob and Leah were buried in Hebron. So what you have is you have the patriarchs, basically. You've got Abraham and Sarah, you've got Isaac and Rebekah, and you've got Jacob and Leah that are all buried at Hebron. Incredible that you can go back 500 years from the time now that Caleb is making his way to Hebron because he has been promised this area right here. You can go back 500 years to a promise that God had made to Abraham that said, I am going to make you a great nation, even though Abraham didn't have any children. But now in this place, he and his children and his descendants are buried. And God said, I'm going to give you a land. In fact, the place that he was actually buried in, Abraham owned because he purchased from the Hittites in the land of Canaan. And this was an actual place that Abraham actually owned, even though he didn't own a whole lot more. And so 500 years earlier from when Caleb is standing at Hebron looking at giants, here's what we know, that there is a promise for him here, but that there are giants both figuratively and literally standing on God's promise. Beneath those giants' feet are Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And their wives, they are buried beneath these giants' feet. And so there are giants standing on Caleb's promise. Now, Caleb ended up believing the promise of God, and he, by God's help, drove these giants out, and he claimed for himself this land that he was living in. But what I want to remind us today is this. Is that this story in the story of redemption is an incredible story, and the event itself is not only real historically, but is also a picture, a type. You see, Joshua, who was raised up to lead the people, is kind of an Old Testament typology of Jesus. As we know, the word Joshua and Jesus, as I told you last week, not only come from the same root, but as a brother friend of mine pointed out, it's the same word. Joshua and Jesus. Joshua is kind of a type in terms of leading the people into the land of promise. The land of promise is a type, not of heaven. The land of promise is a type of the abundant life that God has promised for us, and he gives us the rich inheritance that we have even in this life. And then Caleb is a type because Caleb is a reminder of what true believers in God who follow after him ought to be. They ought to be full of faith. They ought to be patient in trusting the promises of God. They ought to be of a unique and different spirit from the world that we live in. And they ought to be wholehearted in what they do. So we've got this incredible picture. Now, the reason that I talk to us about this idea or this picture is because even now, ladies and gentlemen, we don't just look back with inspiration on what Caleb did. Even now, we are supposed to be mountain takers. And I would say that this particular text reminds us that it doesn't matter how old you are either as to whether or not you're supposed to be a mountain taker, 85 in this text, that we are mountain takers. You see, we've been given, as the people of God, those of us who claim to know Christ, we have been given a rich inheritance in knowing Jesus personally and in the salvation that Jesus brings and the salvation that Jesus offers. And we have the rich inheritance of joining God on his mission for men, women, boys, and girls to hear and see the gospel of Jesus Christ in and through our very lives. We've been given as well in this journey that we're on. We have been given significant promises every time God calls us to be people who take mountains for his glory. We have been given promise upon promise upon promise from God, just like the people of God and specifically Caleb was given. We've been given promises. But here's the thing. There are in our lives giants standing on our promises. There are giants standing on our promises. Now, Caleb had to face the tribe of Anak, which was a tribe of giants. We don't have to face the tribe of Anak, but we face another tribe of giants. Because what do giants do? They scare you. That's what giants do, right? I mean, that's what they do. When you see a giant, you go, ah. They scare you. We face in our journey right now with Jesus, in our lives right now, some of the things that cause us to compromise in our ability to take mountains for the glory of God is we face the giants of fear. There's a lot of those giants in that tribe too. Let me see if I can remind us of a few. The first one that I think of is the fear of death. I have talked with people time after time in the course of a couple of decades of ministry, more than a couple of decades of ministry, who have been paralyzed in their living because of their fear of dying. And as a result, every decision that they make, everything that they do has to do with taking as secure a step as I can possibly take, because I am living and I am walking in a great deal of fear. And the fear is that I'm going to die. I've talked to people who lay awake at night and they actually have trouble sleeping at night because they so fear dying. Now, I'll be honest with you. I get it. There are some people that fear the process of dying. I'm not one who really likes that idea myself. Right? Being dead, no problem. Getting dead, problem. Right? Nobody likes to think about getting dead. Some of us go, okay, I'm okay with being dead, but I don't really like the idea of getting dead. But sometimes this fear is so overwhelming that it actually compromises our ability to do anything, and we make so many decisions based upon the fear that we have of death. But we have to remember the promises of God. Even the promise of Jesus, when some of his friends that he ran into in Bethany and eventually made his way back had experienced the loss of their brother, Mary and Martha. They had experienced the loss of their brother, Lazarus, and Jesus shows up and they're sideways about all of this and probably a little bit not only disquieted but also scared. And remember the words of Jesus in John chapter 11. He says these words. Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live, even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die." Do you believe this? You see, this is a promise from the lips of the Lord Jesus Christ, the Son of Almighty God, God with skin on. And he says, "I am the resurrection and the life. And whoever believes in me, though they die, they will live." So in other words, why would you live your days fearing what is going to happen to every one of us? Because Jesus has said there is something beyond this time. There is something bigger than this time. And he uses the term, "I'm the resurrection and the life." Paul actually capitalizes on it by saying this in 1 Corinthians 15 in that great passage. He says, "When the perishable has been clothed with the imperishable and the mortal with immortality, then the saying that is written will come true. Death has been swallowed up in victory." You see, for the people of God, ladies and gentlemen, listen carefully. For the people of God, the poison has been taken out of the dart of death for the people of God. I know it's no fun. It's not anything that we look forward to in terms of getting dead. I got it. I understand completely. But the poison and the dart, it's gone. Here's why. Because death is going to be stomped out as the final enemy by God. Because what it means is, even though we die and death thinks it is won, Jesus says, "When I return, I'm getting you back up. You are getting back up. Death will not win." So I say this to you. There are times in your life where God is calling you to take a mountain, but the tribe of giants of fear is trying to strike terror into your life by saying, "Well, that's kind of risky and you might die." I might, but I'm getting back up. It is time for us to say, just as Jesus proposed the question, "Do you believe this?" Because if you believe the promise, you'll be able to take the mountain. But there's another giant in this tribe that I think about, and it's the giant of the fear of being alone. This one I have had conversation after conversation with people as well. Jerry, I can't even imagine the thought. It is my greatest fear to think about my spouse not being with me, my spouse dying. I'll be honest with you, I got asked, I was doing a Promise Keepers event up in Toronto, and it was on fear and courage and all those kinds of things, and I didn't preach this message, but it was preaching something different, but they had a round table afterwards, and kind of we're just sitting up there and up top on the platform, and they were asking kind of the presenters about certain things, and so they asked, "What's your biggest fear?" And some of them said some funny things, goofy things, you know, spiders or whatever, you know, and I was just like, "Dude, don't confess that, that's low on the totem pole. This is a dude meeting," and you just said, "I'm scared of spiders." Don't do that. Like, you just immediately had to turn in your Fight Club membership. You're out. "I'm scared of spiders. Why don't you step on that thing? How about that?" So they asked me, and I just got real with them, and I said, I think the greatest fear that I have in life is my wife dying before me. I think it's the greatest fear I have. Now, it doesn't paralyze me, but if I ever stop to think about it, because I think about all the things that she does for our world, and I just think to myself, you know what? Everyone would know how big a joke I am if she wasn't around. I mean, it's, right? And so people live in that fear of, oh, I don't know what I would do. And so, and then we can move into the realm of making them idols or gods. And the one thing I figured out pretty well is that I'm a really bad god for Edie. She's a really bad god for me. Or maybe you think about in terms of being alone, you're single and you're not married, and you think to yourself, man, if I don't ever get married, it's like the worst thing I can think about. I'm running out of time. I don't know if this is ever going to happen. And so I got to get this thing moving down the tracks, because your greatest fear is a fear of being alone. And so as a result of that, instead of taking mountains and doing what God's assigned you for the time that he's assigned you, you make a bad decision based on your fear. You make a bad decision because you're afraid to be alone. Or maybe you're a student in high school or college, and your fear is that you're going to be the only one who confesses to knowing Jesus, and everybody else is doing their thing, right? And they're kind of, here's where the tidal wave of everyone is going, whoa! And I fear being that only person, so I've just got to go along with everybody. You fear that you're actually going to be alone, but you've forgotten the promise. You've forgotten all the promises. And Jesus says in Matthew 28 these words, surely I'm with you always to the very end of the age. Jesus said in John's gospel these words, I'll ask the Father and he will give you another advocate to help you and be with you forever, the Spirit of truth. The world cannot accept him because it neither sees him nor knows him, but you know him, for he lives with you and will be in you. I will not leave you as orphans. I will come to you. You're never going to be alone, ever. This is the promise. Question I ask is, do we believe this? Do we believe this, or are we going to let these giants continue to intimidate us? There's another one in the tribe, and it's the fear of being unloved. You see, this giant shows up in your life when you're trying to take mountains for God. This giant shows up in your life and reminds you of all of your failures and reminds you of how much you have royally messed it up and how worthless you are and how undeserving you are of everything. And any blessing that you get, you should give it back because you don't deserve anything. Well, let me go ahead and solve that for all of us. Listen to how Paul says it in Romans chapter 5, verse 8. God demonstrates his own love for us in this: while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. So here's what that means. While you are and I am completely and totally undeserving, completely and totally not worth loving in our own estimation, while we are maybe completely and royally a mess, here's what God did in the midst of that. While we were in that world, denying him, maybe passively, maybe indirectly, maybe actively, while we were in that world of paying him no attention, he demonstrated his love for us by Christ dying for us. So I can just go ahead and solve it for all of us. None of us are worthy, but he has made us so. I still remember Cinderella when she transformed. It's one of the great theological statements that I've ever read in Disney. When she transformed and was talking with the prince, and she said this: do you love me because I'm beautiful, or am I beautiful because you love me? You see, ladies and gentlemen, at the end of the day, we are beautiful because he loves us. He has made us so. Even when we rejected him, Christ died for us. He has demonstrated his love for us in this. By the way, that promise gets even richer and deeper. Listen to how Paul says it later on in the chapter. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall trouble or hardship or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword? As it is written, for your sake we face death all day long. We are considered as sheep as to be slaughtered. Knowing all these things, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am convinced that neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, neither the present nor the future, nor any powers, neither height nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus our Lord. I don't know if he missed anything. In other words, there is nothing that can separate you as a child of God from the love of God in Jesus Christ. So stop listening to the giant that says that you aren't loved. You are loved eternally with an unfathomable love. This is who we are. But there's other giants. I could probably name a bunch more. Let me just give you this one, and I'll stop with this one. The fear of what following God costs, or the fear of the cost. Ultimately, we go into a lot of things ignorantly. Some of you even came into faith ignorantly. And I don't mean you're ignorant, I just mean we came into it ignorantly. Me and Trace went into the climb of Mount Marcy ignorantly, right? The problem with that is we were so stupid. I'll say I was so stupid, I led the expedition. Trace just came along, I'm not blaming him. I was so stupid that we just went and did the thing. I didn't really know like what this was going to require, how much it was going to cost, how bad I was going to feel, how emotionally drained I would be, how many times I thought I was going to get eaten or die or just stop and live there and get helicoptered out. I didn't know. And after we finished, me and Trace, we were so tired, but we're walking, you know, and we come to the end of the trail, and it's just like we're high-fiving, right? Dude, we did it. And then a little later, man, how was it? That was awesome. You want to do it again? Never. Never. You know why? Because you know what it costs now. Every single step of the way, you realize what it now costs. You didn't know going up. You didn't have any idea. You were ignorant. But now you know what it costs. See, that happens to us a lot, doesn't it? Where we even sometimes come into faith in Jesus Christ and we say, oh yeah, man, this is awesome. And you don't really know what it costs. But then when it starts to really cost something, the giant stands up and says, this is going to cost you some suffering. And you say, yeah, man, I... And we cower in fear. But do you know what Paul says to us in the book of Romans, chapter 8, verse 18? I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing to the glory that will be revealed in us. This is what he says. I consider that the sufferings that we experience right now, it's not even worth a conversation trying to compare that to the glory that's going to be revealed in you. So you know what it says? It's worth it. It's worth it. Every time you have to suffer, every time you get mistreated, it is worth it to continue following Jesus. Because that's the only way that you're going to be able to take a mountain. Remember this, God's promises are bigger than any giant. Now, I'm running out of time, but let me run to the finish line here. A giant is only a giant when you're looking up at it. Did you catch that? A giant is only a giant when you're looking up at it. But when you make a giant look up at something bigger, it's not a giant anymore. A giant's only a giant when you're looking up at it, but when you cause that giant to look up at something bigger, it is not a giant anymore. That is why when we see the giants, when we are trying to take the mountains, we have to call their attention to the God of promise. That we cause these giants that we might be looking up at to cause them to look up and realize they are no longer giants anymore. Because God is bigger and his promises are bigger than any giant we will ever face. And the only way that we can overcome these giants is because the Son of God has come and he went up Mount Moriah and found himself crucified, resurrected from the dead, and he overcame, ladies and gentlemen, all of the fears and all of the forces of hell in that moment. All of the fear of being alone, all of the fear of death, all of the fear of maybe being unloved, all of the fear of the cost that it was going to be. He took it all upon himself, conquered it, rising from the dead, and by the power of the resurrection, now he calls us to be mountain-taking people. This is who we are. Now, we're mountain takers. We are giant slayers. This is who we are. What giant is standing on your Mount Hebron today? And are you going to choose to believe the promises that God has made to you and take the mountain? See, there are no half-hearted mountains. There are no half-hearted giants. And there can be no half-hearted believers. You see, like Caleb, we need to be full of faith. We need to be patient. We need to have a different spirit, and we need to be wholehearted. So, embrace your inheritance. It's something God has called you to. Take hold of the destiny to which God has given you. Embrace every promise that God has made for you. And stop looking up at the giants, and instead tell the giants to look up at the God of promise and take the mountain. Let's bow our heads. Before we leave, if you're here and you've never come to a place of bowing your heart before the Lord Jesus Christ, then no matter what success you have in your life, and no whatever you perceive your mountain to be, you rose in your company or you did whatever, he reminds us, what good is it for a man to gain the whole world and lose his own soul? What good is it for a woman to gain the whole world and lose her own soul? So if you've never come to a place of turning from your sin and putting your faith and trust in Jesus and beginning a true relationship with him, then when we dismiss in a moment, I'd hope you'd come by the fireside room. It's just right out in the atrium. You'll see it clearly marked. And there's pastors and prayer partners. Love to talk to you for just a few moments about what it means to be a genuine follower of Jesus. I hope you won't leave the building without doing that. Father, for those of us who do know you, we know that we've been called to be mountain takers, giant slayers. But God, we compromise in our lives so often because we have this tribe of giants of fear that tries to cause us to cease from walking into the destiny and walking into the inheritance that you have given us in terms of our abundance of life. Life to the full. And God, the world needs to see us to be a people who are living life to the full. Not in the ways that the world defines it, but in the ways that you define it. And if we keep cowering to all of the giants in the world that we live in, we'll never understand what it means to be mountain takers, giant slayers. We can only do that by your grace, and we can only do that in the power of the resurrection, but would you help us to do that? And God, whatever giants are standing on people's Hebrons today, I pray that you would help them to say to the giant that they need to look up to the God of promise, because those giants will cease to be giants in those moments. So God, do what only you can by the power of your Spirit in every life, that we may live out our lives as mountain takers for the glory of God. Thank you for loving us so much to give us this beautiful inheritance of knowing you and being on your mission. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.